For our conference call of January 31st, I'm David Rothberg of Niagara Capital. And this morning, as it's my pleasure, as it is every quarter, to speak with my friend Al Friedberg. Al, good morning.
Good morning, David.
Who is the portfolio manager, as you know, of the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund. Today we'll be speaking about the Global Macro Hedge Fund and a little bit about the Asset Allocation Fund, which shares many of its views. Our format is to speak for about 40, 45 minutes and let everybody get back to work. If you have any questions, please, you can email those questions to Erott, R-O-T-T, at niagaracapital.ca. And if you can't stay on the call for the whole 40 or 45 minutes, we'll post the call on a website and send you a link to the call after we're done. Okay, let's get right down to business. Al, we've had some very good economic news, especially what comes to my mind is the news on the unemployment front. The market, by the standards of many esteemed analysts, has reached a point of self-sustaining growth. And we're not saying that with open arms, but there's at least enough enthusiasm to suggest that that we've entered the early phases of that. People are speaking about the great rotation. And despite all of this, you feel as though uncertainties have not been resolved and you're very cautious. Can you explain why, please?
Okay. David, I'm assuming that when you speak about good news on employment, you're referring, of course, to the U.S.
Yes, I am.
And that's where the good news has been. And no question about it, the U.S. has done well. The economy has picked up a little bit, although yesterday we found out that GDP was lower for the fourth quarter. Most likely will be revised upwards a little bit. Chances are that we are growing somewhere around 2% a year. That seems to be the opinion, the consensus, that we're growing around 2% a year. And it's about in line with what we had expected the U.S. to do. With not a lot of support, meaning that the U.S. consumer disposable incomes have not grown, have shrunk, in fact, and people are dipping into their savings. So we don't have a very strong growth. We have a growth that's built, again, on debt, more leveraging. But it's there, and so the U.S. economy is making some progress, and I think that that's good. And in fact, we are, I wouldn't say unabashedly bullish on the U.S., but we are definitely, if you look at our portfolio, what we are long is U.S. stocks. And we continue to like housing a great deal, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk about it later. But there are some sectors in the U.S. that remain extremely attractive. So yes, we're not as cautious in the U.S. as it might appear. On the other hand, we are very, very concerned about the rest of the world, and there the news are not just not good, but they're getting worse. Europe is continuing to fall into this unending. It's an unending contraction in certainly in the periphery, and now even in the core. Unemployment is rising all over Europe. Japan has had a very weak economic performance. China's barely moved back into a growth phase, if we are to believe their numbers. We're not really sure. And some of the other BRIC countries are not doing great either. So the global picture is pretty glum. Other than the U.S., I think that you're going to have to say that we are experiencing throughout the world, other than the U.S. and Europe, we are experiencing stagflation. In Europe, we're experiencing an outright depression. And in the U.S., we have a little bit of growth, somewhat a little bit of growth. So, my caution has to do with the fact that these markets are all interconnected at some point, And I don't think that one can be bullish on the U.S. without worrying that maybe something will happen at some point to derail the U.S. recovery if the rest of the world continues to weaken, especially if Europe continues to weaken. So that's really the source of our concern, our caution. Something is happening in Europe. It is not good. All we have done is paper it over. We have allowed European governments to relax, not to continue the reform, because we now have the ECB guaranteeing the money at relatively cheap rates, so they don't have to face they don't have to face creditors, and therefore they can get away with things that they wouldn't have been able to get away if the ECB wasn't there. But the fact of the matter is that these economies are continuing to shrink, that the debt burden continues to increase, at least the debt burden in relation to income continues to increase, and it's not sustainable. So at some point it will explode, and when it does, the question is, what will be the effect worldwide, and how will it affect other markets? And this is really the source of our caution.
Before we talk about, I'd like to probe a little bit at some of those points. Let's start with the housing and get it out of the way right away. It's a very good news story from the point of view of the Global Macro Fund. You made this bet an awfully long time ago, and it's you made it at a time when people were looking at the housing market as though it was some version of the apocalypse that was forthcoming. It's as I say, done very well for you. Can you talk a little bit about it to those listeners who aren't quite up to speed with your views?
Well, you know, David, it's a very simple, and it's a great story, and it's a simple story. It's based on the fact that they are the prime beneficiaries, the housing sector is the prime beneficiary of this artificial manipulation of rates and this huge monetary accommodation that central bank is giving us. So that that policy has lowered mortgage rates to the point where today you can buy a house and be guaranteed a profit. Basically, you know, you pay 3.5%, let's say, on a 30-year mortgage, and you're already making this year 8 or 9 or 10% profit on the capital appreciation. So it's a real it's an inflation play. It's a housing inflation play, and I think that anybody that can borrow such money at long term at those rates, I think it'd be crazy not to, and it'd be crazy not to buy the largest and the best house that he can afford. So that story is a simple story. So, and this is something that we saw more than a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and it's done well, and I think that will continue to do well. It will continue to surprise the market how strong the sector will recover. It's not as much a, and I think a lot of observers are making a mistake and looking at the numbers. It's not as much a story about numbers, how many houses are we building and how many square feet we're building, but it's a story about prices. Prices, because of the relative shortage now of housing in good places, where people want them, where the demand is, house prices are rising very quickly, and the margins are excellent. And I think that these builders are now enjoying terrific margins, and they're making extraordinary profits, and this can last for a little while. So that story is simple. You don't have to be a genius. You don't have to know anything about quantum math or any fancy mathematics. It's simply the Fed has made money available, has given the money away, is giving the money away. The rates are cheap, really, really cheap, and you can buy a house today and enjoy the ride.
Is it the is location the single distinguishing factor from or the single factor that distinguishes the housing market from buying a basket of stocks or a basket of commodities? In the case of stocks, you can now finance a basket of stocks where the borrowing costs are less than the dividend yield in many cases, and by the same token, to buy a basket of commodities, the carrying charges in many cases are virtually negligible. So what's really the difference between housing and those other two asset classes?
I'm not sure what you're asking about it, but housing has a distinctive characteristic, which is A, you live in it, you use it. It's a consumer good in some sense. It's not as if you're buying something to put away that you don't need. And secondly, you can get very long-term financing. You can get 30-year financing in a house. You cannot get 30-year financing on purchasing copper. So housing is in an unusual position.
So are you to carry the argument a step further, where do you stand on the stock market and on the commodity markets?
Well, you know, again, with regards to the U.S., we think that there's still upside there, especially in that sector. We have, you know, we have positions in other ones too, but we think that one is still a no-brainer. We have a heavy emphasis in housing, and actually, it is something that we need to manage properly because volatility in that sector is higher than for the rest of the market. And so a day that housing stocks don't do well, you know, can cost quite a bit. But other than that, we continue to like that. And what we need to do is to find, and this is what we're trying to do, is we need to find offsets in other markets where we feel that should something happen, that we can protect ourselves. And so we are being short, as you all know, because I've written about it quite a number of times. We've been short some of the emerging markets like India and Brazil. We've been short Australia because we think that the housing boom there has come to an end, and the banks will begin to suffer. And because the mining boom also has come to an end, and by their own weight, that the mining boom has come to an end because Australia has been so successful in mining and has created such an enormous supply of things like iron ore and coal. And so we're short areas and markets that we believe will be affected should global economy would turn down. And we remain long, as I say, basically the U.S. That's, I think, the only market that we are long in a big way.
Let's go back to Europe for just a second. You speak about you refer to economic activity in Europe as being in the state of depression. At the same time, and if you look at the numbers, especially in Spain, they're staggering. There are more people unemployed in Spain than were unemployed during the Great Depression in the United States when Okies were moving to California and playing guitars. But yet, bond yields have declined, and there's a sense of complacency that belies that entirely. What do you think is going on there?
You know, that's a game. That is exactly the game. I think the central banks believe that they can by making money available, by guaranteeing access to the credit markets, they believe that they can transition. They can create this transition to finally the moment in which example, Spain or Portugal can reach their fiscal surplus and can turn around their fiscal policy. I think that this is the idea behind it is give them time, and the way to give them time is make credit available to them or tell the market that you will make credit available to them, that there will be no crisis. And what's happening is, of course, what always happens, which is these governments are taking advantage now of the fact that they can borrow money cheaply. They're not really coming through with any major reform. They're continuing to raise taxes. So underneath, everything is crumbling. On the surface, it looks good. Traders who are very short-term players will come in and buy these bonds and trade these bonds and sell them and buy them and sell them and feel good about them. But beneath this whole structure, it's crumbling. And at some point, the population will will feel and say that this is not worth the candle. So at some point, population will say, we will not continue to pay higher taxes and try to generate enough money or try to generate a surplus to be able to pay interest on the debt. And so some kind of a restructuring of the debt will take place. But for now, I think everybody's happy, and this is what the Fed does. I think the Fed and the ECB are providing short-term relief at the expense of long-term pain.
When you say that you're looking, when you said that you were looking conceptually for counter trades to your long exposure to the very volatile housing sector, does your caution really emanate from the possibility of a tail event originating in Europe?
Right, exactly. Tail event emanate from Europe or emanate from other places. Europe is one of them. Europe is maybe the more likely source of such an event, but there could be other places. We got to remember that generally speaking, the world economy is really not on solid footing. It's built on a lot of credit. It's built on a lot of debt, much more so than we've had since World War II. And it's very vulnerable to small changes, to events that can make things break down very quickly. So a tail event can happen because some event makes the price of oil go up $50 or $70, or because of some country in Europe decides to default unilaterally. Or a number of other things that we haven't even foreseen. I don't know, North Korea decides to attack South Korea. Things of that sort. Anything like this can trigger an event. And because economies are not well supported, they are built, there's very little margin of safety. Consumers are heavily indebted, and they're also saving very little money out of their income. The fiscal, let's say the public sectors are so overextended to begin with that they're not able to increase their deficit and bring about some counter-cyclical policies. It's a lot more difficult for the U.S. and for Europe and for the rest of the world to do something significant on a fiscal basis in 2013 than it was in 2008. We have now spent so much money, and we have spent so much of the potential that we had, that it's unlikely that these governments can ever do the same thing again. So a tail event can happen, and this time the tail event may not have to be a very serious thing. It doesn't have to be something out of this world, and yet it can have very vast consequences because the system is so vulnerable, because the world economy is so vulnerable today.
So if you're managing a portfolio now in which you're sanguine about the U.S., extremely anxious about the possibility of a tail event destroying capital, how do you hedge yourself in such a way that, A, the costs of the hedge are not prohibitive, and, B, you can still make a decent return this year? You know, we're now facing the Warren Buffett challenge, whereby he said, you know, a simple bet on the beta of the stock market will outperform the vast majority of hedge funds. I think it was 2015, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a horse race now. How do you do it?
Well, it's not easy. You know, if you want to hedge for those type of events, it costs money. and every time you put on a trade, because that trade is going to be a hedge, it's going to cost you a significant amount of money. We experienced that last year, where we lost quite a bit of money in let's say buying a European CDS, expecting a sovereign default. So, or you buy options, and options cost money. It's not a simple proposition. I think what the best thing that you can do, and what we are trying to do, is to put on trades that we believe will, without a tail event, produce decent results. So that being, let's say, short Brazil today, we think that, you know, Brazil has very little upside in the market. Why? Well, the economy is mired in inflation. It's a very stubborn inflation rate, very stubborn inflation rate. It's at the top of the central bank's target range. They're not able really to bring it down. The reason they're not able to bring it down is because their monetary policy is very easy. So is fiscal policy, very lax. Unemployment rate just hit a new record low. It's very hard for them to bring down inflation. Well, inflation, if you can't bring down inflation, you're not going to get a very good economic performance, and you're not getting good economic performance. You know, the economy is barely growing in Brazil. So our feeling is that if the whole world was going to resume growth and was going to go back to something like what happened in the 60s or what happened in the 90s, Brazil would not participate in a big way in this thing. And if it doesn't participate in a big way, it means that being short Brazil is not going to cost us a lot of money. On the other hand, if things turn sour, Brazil should make us some money. So this is the type of trades that we're looking for. We're looking for trades that were things to get better from here. They would not cost a great deal of money, but we're not talking about buying premium or buying something with premiums, or not buying options or anything of that sort. We're just simply saying there are markets that have been overextended, the markets that have very little upside left to them. India is an example where now inflation rate is 9-10% a year. This bank rate is down to 8%. That means that the bank rate is once again negative. They try whatever they can to stimulate the economy, but they can't lower rates any more than where they are now. The fiscal side of India is a mess. The deficit is equal to at least 6, if not 7 or 8% of GDP. Corruption is rampant. So it's unlikely that the Indian market has a lot of upside. Those are the kinds of things that we are attracted to, so that we can protect a little bit the long side of a portfolio.
Yeah, I would characterize those as conceptual opportunistic hedges rather than conventional hedges, where you're in effect having to pay an insurance policy for protection that's similar to the same kind of protection that everyone else is buying.
Correct. We're not buying protection as much. Now, there is protection that we can buy, and we have maintained a position in CDSs, because today credit default swaps on Spain, on Portugal, on some of the European countries are cheap, are quite cheap. And we have not been able to increase the position recently. We've tried. Market is not very liquid, but what we own is a good chunk, and at these levels, I think the cost is quite small, and I believe that we can benefit greatly if something happens there.
Let's turn for just a second to the difference between the global macro hedge fund and the asset allocation fund. For the listeners, I think you can safely presume that the conversation so far really pertains to the global macro hedge fund, but Al, your asset allocation fund really is invested on the basis of exactly the same economic or macro views that you put into place in the global macro fund. Now, in the asset allocation fund, you don't have the latitude to buy credit default swaps or to go short markets that you think may opportunistically fall in the event of some tail event. So how do you position a portfolio like it, like the asset allocation fund, where all you can do is go long one of the five major asset classes?
Well, what we do is we look for safe havens. And so we have a much higher portion of funds invested in fixed income, in this case, U.S. government, because we want the best quality, and a much smaller proportion in non-fixed income, like equities. We have a smaller position in equity. Again, we have our equity position is overrepresented in the housing sector, but it's a much smaller position. So without having to be short, and without having to do any hedges, we have a more defensive view of the market. It's not going to be an exact replica. It can never be an exact replica because we can't do the same trades, but it has a similar taste and a similar tone to it.
Thanks. This kind of leads naturally, I think, to a discussion about commodities, and in particular, I think what's of interest is your views on gold and on oil. I know you've been bearish on oil. You've tended to have a bullish bias that's somewhat, at least at the present time, diminished regarding gold. Can you give us a bit of an update on where you stand with those two in particular and with the commodity markets in general? I'm speaking more from the point of view of your discussion about liquidity and central bank amplitude.
Well, here is a dilemma. If you had a world in which you had no monetary inflation and simply looked at the industrial production in the major industrial countries, and you'd see what was happening today, you'd say that commodity prices should go lower. Demand is certainly shrinking for many, many commodities, including base metals and coal and natural gas and so. Well, natural gas is not decreasing, but the demand for many of the industrial commodities is decreasing. So if you'd have a world with no inflation or no monetary inflation, you'd say that you'd probably want to be short commodities. And gold would not do extremely well in that environment either. Gold has other characteristics. It has a monetary component of sorts. We see it re-entering the monetary system by seeing all these central banks buying every month a little bit of gold. So we have to set aside gold a little bit. So gold is somewhere between a commodity and money. But other than that, other commodities should not do well in the environment that we're in today. Problem is that we're not in that world. We're in a world in which central banks are furiously printing money. The U.S. and the European and central bank and now Japan and China's money supply is growing at an incredibly fast clip. Now that it's slowed down, it's growing at about 12 to 14% per annum. But if you go back over 5, 6, 7 years, money supply in China has more than doubled. And if you take the fact that the exchange rate, the one to dollar exchange rate, has been pretty steady, you know, within 3 or 4 percentage points, that means that the dollar or dollar equivalent money supply in the world has increased by an enormous amount. Other than the increase in dollar money supply in the U.S., you had this very large increase in money in other countries, and China is one of them. So
and now Japan,
Japan. So you have money increasing all over the world. And this means that commodity prices are supported by this monetary expansion, and they don't respond to what we might have expected had we just looked at industrial production and GDP and real GDP. This is the problem. This is where we can't really decide. I mean, do we want to be short copper at 374, given what's going on in Europe and what's going on in the rest of the world? Yes. But do we want to really be short copper when we see that the money's growing maybe at 10 or 12 or 15% per annum around the world? I don't think so. And I'm not really sure how this is going to be resolved. I do think that it is not good for the economy to have commodity prices higher than they should be. In other words, we are not allowing, monetary policy is not allowing prices to clear easily. This makes it more difficult for the economy to adjust and makes it more difficult for the economy to turn around. I believe that that's a major mistake that the Fed is making, that by making money loose, they are raising the level of commodity prices. They're maintaining a higher than desired inflation rate, and therefore they are impeding the rate of growth. I would think that a deflation of 2% a year would be a lot more helpful to the economy today than an inflation rate of 2% a year. And I think this is the problem. So when people say, well, there's no real inflation, it's true. But it's a lot higher than it would have been to clear the market. It's a lot higher than it would have been that there would be in order to clear the market. So now let me go back to oil.
I want to bring you back to oil.
Question. Yeah, oil is of course one of the most important commodities, and now we see around the world that the supplies are continuing to increase. Non-OPEC supplies are increasing. We're finding now oil in other ways. Shale oil is making a big contribution. We know in the U.S. Oil production has risen to a multi-year high. Also, natural gas is a competitor in some way to oil, and it will become more so over the years as we can make substitution. So that tends to bring prices down. So generally speaking, our view has been that oil should be coming down, and a reasonable price for oil is a price that's below $50.
Statement. In the 60s they used to say that's a radical statement, man. A very radical statement.
Radical. Like in the 60s there were people who were radical.
Exactly.
Right. I do think that the price should be below 50 anyway, given supply and demand. Now again, covering this thing like there is like a cloud, and the cloud is money. And now there's a lot of money in the market, and there's a lot of players with a lot of money, and there's a lot of institutions with a lot of money, and there's a lot of programs that buy commodities as a hedge against inflation. And all these players financing themselves with very low-cost money, 1% a year, less than 1% a year, are able to buy commodities, and one of the commodities they buy is oil. And so this market may not break and may even go higher because of the quantity of money in the system. So oil is in the very same position. My guess is that the day that loose monetary policy comes to an end, the day that the Federal Reserve and the ECB and so on decide that they can no longer afford doing what they're doing, we will see many, many commodity prices go down very rapidly, very quickly, because we will be disgorging large inventories, and it will come down very quickly. But that could take a long time. So short of that event, even though I can be bearish on the oil, but I don't have a lot of hope that I'm going to see the price go down in a big way while this monetary policy is playing itself out.
Okay, thank you. We've got about 5-10 minutes left, and I think that this leads us pretty organically to probably the biggest question, at least from the point of view of futures traders, what's going to happen to the bond market? And before we get there, I think what we have to do is talk a little bit about money supply. You were an old Milton Friedman guy in your when you were a slightly younger man, and I thought I might ask you to read a little bit the monetary tea leaves. The last I looked at those charts on the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis bulletins, the Fed was providing a lot of money, but not a lot of it was finding its way into the banking system. So where are we at there?
Well, it's starting to pick up. You know, it's funny. It's starting to pick up. The broad monetary aggregates are starting to grow around 10% a year now, which is consistently higher than it was, let's say, last year. And we have seen a very interesting upward inflection in loans by the banking system. We've been growing loans at around 4 or 5% a year through all of 10 and 11, I think that was, if I recall. And in the last few months, we have seen loans pick up, and we are now growing something close to 12% a year. So it may be that finally, excess reserves are finding their way into loans and into more investments. And so if that's the case, we will begin to see an acceleration of money. And if we see an acceleration of money growth, we will begin to see then the effect, which is more inflation. So even though the jury is still out, and even though the process took longer or takes longer than we thought it would, but it seems to be happening. It's taking place, and it's taking place slowly, and we should watch it. It's worth watching. And it could have very, very important consequences. Again, as an example, if this thing continues, if 12% rate of growth of loan then turns into 15, and money supply rises at 15% per annum or begins to accelerate beyond that level, the Fed is going to have a big problem, a very, very big problem. And it may decide to call it quits. Quantitative easing may have to end earlier than they thought, earlier than their idea that they would end it if unemployment reaches 6.5% and inflation breaches 2.5%. I mean, they may have to at some point. They may have to, if in the face of rising money supply, they may have to end it earlier. And then we have all sorts of problems. All sorts of problems. I mean, how quickly will the market adjust to higher rates, to higher inflation? These things can come very, very quickly. And just to remind you, David, I think you were with me at the time, at the very beginning in 1971, when money had been growing for a few years higher than or faster than anybody had expected, and then but inflation was quiescent, was very, very quiet. And you didn't know there was any problem, and you had just come out of a recession in 1970 and 71, and then came the great Russian purchase of wheat. Suddenly, out of nowhere, the Russians bought wheat, and the price of wheat went up like 60 or 70% in 1 or 2 months, if you recall.
Right.
And that began the entire boom in commodities and the huge rise in commodity prices. And inflation, right? So the 70s. So it came out of nowhere. Well, it's not that it came out of nowhere. The money was around. The money was somewhere.
Precondition was there. But Albert, doesn't this, to bring it back to the bond market, doesn't this make it virtually impossible? Aren't you constructing an airtight argument not to hold bonds? And I'm thinking now to where you stand with the asset allocation portfolio. Because if you see money supply increase, either the Fed is going to have to is going to have to behave in a way that many people predict, for political reasons, they won't be able to behave, that's to say, to drain reserves, or bond vigilantes will do the job for them. In either case, bond yields rise and bonds fall.
Yeah. Okay, but there's two counter-arguments here. First of all, our core position is TIPS, and TIPS do incorporate that inflation premium, so that it is possible that as inflation picks up, our bonds will continue to do well. So that, I don't think that that's a problem. In fact, chances are that the real yields will dig deeper into negative territory and will make the TIPS even more attractive. So you may have TIPS trading at, I don't know, at 30% higher than they are today, or 40% higher than that today, if long rates go negative, which we think they will. The argument that you're making is more towards the nominal rate, nominal bonds, and I agree with you. I think that the argument for holding long-term bonds, nominal long-term bonds, is not a good one. It's only at this moment, we're holding some of them at the moment, more for reasons of balancing the portfolio than for a long-term investment. We do think that it's they will suffer greatly in where inflation begins to accelerate. And I think that that's something that we have to take into account and can only be a short-term investment. And by the way, it's very interesting. We are long some nominal bonds in both global macro and the asset allocation, again, more for as a trading vehicle than as an investment, in contradistinction to the TIPS. But we are also short, and started going short in our global macro fund, JGBs, Japanese 10-year securities. And there, I think the case is even stronger because the government wants to increase the inflation rate to 2%, and they're going to go all out to do that. And these JGBs yield only 0.7 or 0.65 or 0.75, something like that. So they're certain losers should the government succeed in bringing inflation up to 2%. And because the debt to GDP ratio in Japan is much higher than it is in the U.S., it's more likely that the accident will happen first in Japan than it will happen in the United States. But anyway, we have to be cautious because such a tail event, I call it a tail event because nobody is really expecting an explosion of money in the next few months, but such an event could happen. And if it happens, it can have very, very severe consequences.
Okay, thank you, Al. We've run out of time, I think. I don't want to take any more of your time or any more of our listeners' time. Last year was your first losing year since you started the fund in 2001. You lost about 8.5%, and you're well on your way to making that back. You're up about 6% as of yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, in your global macro portfolio. Wish you the best of luck in the coming quarter and, of course, throughout the rest of the year. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
Good luck, investors. And again, a link to the call will be sent to you. It will be posted on our websites. I wish you all best of luck during the coming quarter.